Investors Chronicle.
Hello and a very warm welcome back to the IC Interviews podcast. I'm Dave Baxter. I'm the funds editor on the IC. And joining me today is Laura Foll, a portfolio manager at Janus Henderson and part of the team running the investments on the Lord Debenture Corporation Investment Trust. That's a UK income trust of more than a billion in size, with many of the usual attractions of its peers, from yield to capital growth. However, it does also take some perhaps less conventional approaches that will influence how the team thinks. So Laura, thanks for coming on. How are you doing?
Thanks very much for having me. I'm very good, thanks. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Yeah, busy day for you guys. Now the trust's results have come out, so plenty to discuss, I think. But firstly, I kind of alluded to it just then, but it might be interesting to very briefly sort of go through how you think the trust is differentiated from its peers. I think, you know, there's one thing that stands out to me that would be worth kind of outlining.
So it has one very big difference versus its peers, which is that it's pretty unique in its structure. I haven't come across another structure similar to it, in that it has an operating business within the trust structure. So let me explain. It has what we call an independent professional services business. This is a mixture of different corporate services. It has pension trustee, it has whistleblowing, it has corporate secretarial work, all sorts of different business services within an investment trust structure. That IPS business is roughly 20% of the trust's NAV, but most crucially, it provides roughly a third of the overall income for the trust. So what that allows me and James Henderson, we run the portfolio side of it, so the other 80% in the NAV, what that allows me and James to do is to run the portfolio side with a lower dividend yield than the broader market, while the trust as a whole still yields roughly 4% today, and the dividend with the full year results has just gone up another 5%. So the trust as a whole yields 4%, so that's roughly in line with the broader UK market, but the portfolio yield is lower. That might sound slightly nuanced, but what that effectively means is that the investment universe for me and James is broader. So rather than focusing on what is often a fairly narrow range of UK dividend payers, you know, we'd all know the names, the Unilevers, the GSKs, the HSBCs of the world, it broadens out that investment universe and allows us to hold lower yielding shares that have often gone on to be among the better performing shares for that portfolio. So the real uniqueness versus its peer group, so it's in the AIC UK income sector, is that very different structure that's been around for a long time and brought about by having that IPS business within it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I was interested to see in the trust results, there was quite a bit of discussion even of kind of, you know, holding companies that kind of don't even pay dividends or don't currently pay dividends, which I suppose in part can relate to maybe kind of recovery plays and that kind of thing. What kind of names, what sectors are you guys kind of focusing on where, you know, perhaps a company has paused its dividend or is relatively low? You know, what are the interesting opportunities that perhaps a more conventional income investor might not be looking at so much?
I think just before I talk about stock specifics, and I'm happy to give you a couple of examples, I think the point at which a company cuts its dividend is often an interesting point to take a look, which might sound strange coming from an income fund manager, but if you're talking about a company that is in theory heading for a recovery, take M&S a couple of years ago, you know, when it, which we hold and is one of our bigger holdings, you know, when it took its dividend to zero, it was a real admission by the company that something had gone very wrong. And you get Archie Norman coming in, you know, he's not the new chairman anymore, he's the chairman. There was an annual report a couple of years ago that was really, really brutal in its assessment of where M&S was and saying all the things that needed to change in the business and all the things that had gone wrong. And actually, that was the point at which we thought, yes, this is interesting now, because M&S is something that's had potential for a long time and it needed to take a long, hard look at itself. You know, it still had the market share. People want to support it. You can almost feel people in the UK, they want M&S to have something that they want to buy. People want to go there and buy some clothes. It took a real hard look and the dividend going to zero for that to begin its recovery. And that's difficult. If you're running a yield fund, an income fund that needs to hit a certain yield threshold, so you're running an open-ended fund, and to stay in the sector, you need to hit the benchmark yield over a three-year period. It's hard for you to hold zero-yielding shares in size. You can hold some and it can balance out across the rest of the portfolio. But you'd have a hard time holding recovery shares like that as your biggest holding or a good chunk of your top 10. But actually, that is an interesting time to be looking at those types of companies. So M&S would be one, you know, Rolls would be another. Both of those are among our biggest holdings in Lordeb. And we were able to hold them and keep holding them. You know, Rolls is now our biggest position, even though it doesn't yet pay a dividend. It, you know, it might sometime soon, but it doesn't at the moment. You know, there are other recovery shares that we own and are looking at, like IDS, which is much better known as Royal Mail, which, you know, may pay a dividend, but that's not the key factor in our decision. You know, we can look at these companies that pay very little dividend or no dividend and know that the IPS business, you know, thankfully we can come in on day one of the year and have a pretty good confidence that we've got a third of the income for the year in the bag, which is very, very unusual in an investment trust structure. So it just gives us that freedom to look at that type of recovery share and crucially keep holding them rather than having to sell our winners if the recovery does go on to be successful.
Mm. And what do you, I mean, that's, I suppose that's quite interesting to think of a dividend cut as a perhaps a contrarian kind of buy indicator. But, you know, if that's something that kind of flags your interest, what then do you look for? I mean, as I said, maybe Marks Spencer is an interesting one to examine, but what do you look for then to kind of think this is a solid recovery play rather than, you know, classic value trap, that kind of thing?
I think there has to be a genuine admission of what's gone wrong and what needs doing. So take another example. Take something like Babcock. Again, we held that. I think it does now pay a dividend again, or possibly heading there anyway. If it does, it's very low yield. We bought that when it was zero yielding. It had a new CEO and new CFO. And they, in my view, they were correcting the mistakes of the past. So it used to have very opaque accounting. Some would describe it as pretty aggressive accounting as well. They corrected that. They did a number of disposals. The balance sheet's now in a much better place. They've been trying to get their contract structured in a way that they're taking on much less fixed price risk. So effectively, it's a contractor. It serves the defence markets, but effectively, it's a contractor. And it had a number of fixed price contracts. They've been working their way through. There's still some way to go on that. They've been working their way through trying to get those contracts priced more conservatively. I think when you're looking at something like that, you've got to think, is where they're heading to a business that you want to own? So with something like Babcock, it's very, very specialist defence work. It's things like, you know, submarine decommissioning, that kind of work. There are very few companies in the UK capable of doing that kind of work. It's in the defence markets. You know, we all know that there are potential structural tailwinds for the defence markets now. So it should be specialist in what it's doing. It's potentially got structural growth drivers. If they can get to where they want to get to, that looks like a business that's worth owning. You know, with something like Rolls, one of the market leaders in civil aerospace engines, you know, one of the global market leaders. We don't have that many, unfortunately, we don't have that many companies in the UK that are global market leaders in what they're doing. So Rolls, you know, manage better, cost taken out. You can see that where it's potentially going to is a business that you would want to own. So yes, there might be no dividend in the interim, but is the sort of end game of where the management teams are trying to get to, is that a business that's worth paying attention to?
Mm.
You know, M&S, the food business has always been a decent business, but now it's taking market share. Clothing actually held on to quite a lot of market share. You know, when it's back winning market share as it is now, potentially a good business. You know, still potentially a market leader. So that's what we're looking at. And, you know, don't look at things today. Look at things with sort of a 3-5 year view. We're really fortunate, actually, to have a vehicle that's able to take that kind of time horizon, helped by the structure of the trust. But that's what we're looking at.
And sticking with Rolls-Royce, I suppose that's turned lots of heads. You know, I was looking at a handful of kind of UK funds earlier this year, and, you know, some have had enormous returns last year, partly because they've held Rolls-Royce and it had such a huge run, you know, enormous returns. I guess, firstly, you know, you talk about kind of time horizons and so on, but how do you treat a stock when it's up by something like 200%? I mean, do you have price targets? In the case of Rolls, have you sort of been trimming back? And what's the kind of story there?
We haven't been trimming. It's something we've been, as you can imagine, it's something we've been actively looking at. I think you have to keep going back to valuation.
Mm.
And actually, in the case of Rolls, a lot of the share price move last year was driven by upgrades rather than a re-rating. if you catch my drift, that there have been a lot of upgrades on both the free cash flow side and on the earnings side, driven by a combination of things that might be common sense. You know, we're back to flying almost how we were pre-COVID. And it's taken a surprisingly long time for those flying hours to catch up to where they were just in 2019. So that recovery is only just finishing now in terms of the flight hours. So there's the combination of that structural tailwind, if you like, from the flying hours, and also a much more of a cost and pricing focus under a new management team. So they are, in a way, the new management team have been enabled by the management teams of the past. They've got the market share now. So in a way, that work is done. And now they can take costs out, and they're doing that quite aggressively, and also enforce pricing. You know, they are the market leader. They have differentiated technology. They should be able to adequately price for their products. And I think that's a real discipline under the new management team. So as you can imagine, it is our biggest holding. We are actively looking at it, but the valuation is still at a discount to overseas peers. And actually, it hasn't re-rated hugely. It's been driven, as I said, by upgrades. But, you know, it's front of mind. It's our biggest holding.
Mm. Is the discount to kind of international peers, I mean, how valid a metric is that? Because surely that's quite a widespread thing.
So that's on free cash flow yield, which I think is the metric that most people tend to use for a company like Rolls. I think there's always, you know, given the history of, you know, being really upfront, there has been a history of disappointment with a company like Rolls. So people are always a bit sceptical of the targets they give. I think they're slowly becoming less sceptical because there has recently been a better track record. But when a company like that comes out with a medium-term target, as they did, you know, towards the end of last year, it is still treated with a degree of scepticism. So I think that's why there is still a discount compared to peers, because people, you know, there is an element of, well, prove it.
Mm.
And, you know, to give the new management team their credit, they have, you know, they have so far been delivering on what they're saying. So maybe with time that valuation discount, you know, if they do manage to hit the targets, can steadily go.
And how do you feel about the kind of dividend prospects? Because I suppose there's this idea that payout should resume once the investment grade credit rating is restored. You know, is that something that's kind of prominent in your minds when you're thinking about the kind of case for sticking with it and so on?
I think for a company like Rolls, I'm sure they have a long list of potential organic investments that they could potentially use that money. Potentially, this is a bit controversial as an income investor, but I'll say it anyway. You know, I'm sure they have a list of CapEx opportunities that would be pretty long. You know, whether it's in nuclear, whether it's in narrow body. You know, I don't think, in terms of total return from owning Rolls, I don't think dividend is going to be the thing that makes the difference. Let's put it that way. You know, you could get a yield of a couple of percent. Is that going to convince the marginal holder to buy Rolls? I don't think so. I think if they had a, you know, a world leading proposition in, you know, modular nuclear, that might, you know, potential US holder, for example, that to my mind would be the thing that would make you cross the line, not paying a 2-3% dividend.
Mm.
So that's not, you know, when we're thinking about Rolls, that's not particularly front of mind, if I'm being really upfront about it.
I mean, obviously there's lots of debate about, you mentioned kind of capital allocation, you know, in the last year we've seen lots of buybacks, which is interesting, but more generally, I suppose there's a broader debate about the extent to which UK companies and particularly large caps are, you know, some people would argue a bit overly focused on this kind of dividend addiction and so on, and whether we should be more like the US, whether there should be more kind of focus on growth opportunities. I mean, do you hear much from kind of UK listed companies now about kind of a shift away from the kind of dividend focus and more towards something else, or how are things kind of panning out?
I think it's an interesting question, because I feel like that shift has already happened in the UK. And I think that the shift was COVID.
Mm.
So during COVID, you know, it was a terrible time to be running income funds, because the UK market income fell about 50%, you know, with a bit of rounding in it. But what that did to a lot of the UK market is it, in one fell swoop, took away the dividend track record. So before that, you had a lot of companies where they had dividend track records, you know, sometimes 20 decades, you know, built up over decades, and they were very reluctant to, you know, destroy that record But with COVID, a lot of dividends went to zero, and then you're starting with a completely fresh sheet of paper. So the board is there effectively on day one deciding what dividend payout ratio do we actually want for this company. And a lot of boards and executives took the decision at that point to change the dividend and set a payout ratio that's lower. So if you look at the UK market payout ratio, it was knocking up at 70% pre-COVID, and it's now more like 45%, which feels like a much more healthy payout ratio. And that, you know, it might sound weird coming from a UK income fund manager, but actually that dividend cut, I think if we look back on it in 10 years' time, will be a good thing, because it meant companies really thought about, okay, what do we really want our payout ratio to be? And you've seen some companies go, okay, well, it was 50% and now it's a third, and we'll take that extra, you know, cash that would have gone out the door, and we will use it for CapEx, or we will use it for bolt-ons, or, you know, we can talk about share buybacks. I mean, using it for share buybacks. But it just gives that extra flexibility where some companies had, if they were being really honest, they probably wouldn't ever put this, well, they definitely wouldn't put it in a press release, but they had possibly backed themselves into a bit of a corner with the dividend pre-COVID, and this gave them the reason to start fresh. And I think that's actually a good and healthy thing for the UK market.
Yeah, saw some kind of rebasing, and I suppose with some investment trusts as well, which is quite interesting. In terms of, though, you know, obviously you do kind of have to generate some yield. What are the kind of interesting sectors, areas that are kind of powering the dividend part of the portfolio, you know, ignoring the business itself?
I think financials is often an area that gets looked at for yield. So to give a few examples, you know, we recently added a position in Lord Ebb as well as elsewhere in an insurer called Beazley. You know, it's one of the leaders in cyber insurance in the US, and they're trying to launch. Europe hasn't been as big of an area for cyber insurance, but it's growing from a smaller base, and hopefully Beazley will go on to be one of the leaders there as well. I think what's quite interesting to me about a company in a position like that is that it's got that potential growth angle from cyber, but it's also paying, I think the ordinary yield is around 3%. So that on the face of it doesn't look super attractive, but it also could potentially return further cash to shareholders through, and we don't know the route yet, but it will either be a buyback or a special dividend. They've announced that. They just haven't said the route at which it's coming back. So we'll get roughly a 3% ordinary and then a sort of kicker on top of that via this capital return because of the strength of the balance sheet. So I think, you know, a position like that is potentially interesting because you get the capital angle and the income angle. And financials more broadly is often an area that you look at for yield. So, you know, the banks aren't everyone's cup of tea, and obviously they have this remarkable ability to kind of shoot themselves in the foot from time to time. But they do tend to pay an attractive yield. So, you know, take Barclays as an example. We had the, it wasn't a capital markets day, I think it was called an investor day last week, but they announced essentially returning 50% of their market cap to shareholders, if you believe the targets that they've put out there, by 2026, which is quite remarkable, really. If, you know, if they get anywhere near those targets, you know, getting 50% of your market cap back, you don't often hear that. So financials would be an area that I would point to that's already paying an attractive yield and with some potential to grow. I'd say there are other areas, you know, some of which we've spoken about that are coming from very low yields that have the potential to recover. So something like M&S that we've spoken about, you know, it's paying a penny in dividends. Its earnings are 20p plus. You know, you'd think even if they were trying to be conservative with the payout ratio, which they may well be, you know, one penny on over 20p of earnings looks particularly low. So you would think that a dividend and something like that would have good potential to recover from a low level. So there are lots of areas that you could look at. But I think what gives me confidence for the market as a whole is that point around the 45% payout ratio for the UK market, which doesn't look stretched by historical standards.
I suppose kind of flipping the coin, are there any warning signs you would identify in terms of, I mean, I guess, you know, you stressed to the point that you don't need to chase yields, but that is a concern for income investors. Are there kind of red flags that you would tend to look for on income stocks?
I think a couple of years ago, there were red flags, and we own GSK and we have owned GSK for a long time. But I think, you know, if I look back a couple of years ago at GSK, if I was sort of reading between the lines, I think their dividend prior to the reset that happened when they sold the consumer business. So when they sold Haleon, whenever it was a couple of years ago, they rebased the dividend, and that gave them a good reason to rebase the dividend. I think if you go back to the dividend a few years ago, I think they, you know, if you were trying to read between the lines of what the chief exec was saying, what the board was saying, I think they knew they were over-distributing. And it was just a matter of time before they found a reason to rebase the dividend.
Mm.
And the consumer health sale gave them a good reason to do that, and the dividend is now at a more sustainable level and more in tune with its pharmaceutical peers. So that's fine, and we were supportive of that. I can't, off the top of my head, I'm struggling to think of an equivalent of that today. I think, there have been a lot of outflows from UK income funds and a lot of outflows from UK equities generally.
Mm.
And I think that means that capital allocation policies from UK corporates now are maybe less in tune with the UK income funds and more in tune with who might be the marginal buyer. And often that's from the States.
Yeah.
And the marginal buyer from the States is often saying to these companies, no, don't do a dividend, do a buyback. And capital allocation priorities are slightly being skewed by that, potential marginal buyer. So I think that means there's less over-distribution broadly because companies are thinking with possibly more with that shareholder in mind than its traditional long-only UK income fund.
I suppose that is slightly problematic for an income investor, perhaps, because I guess if you have things like buybacks or even special dividends, that's more kind of an ad hoc phenomenon, isn't it? Rather than like having something locked in that you can...
So I think dividend forecasting is becoming harder.
Hmm.
I think dividends are now more tied to earnings. Companies are saying, my payout ratio is 30% and that's what you're getting. So take a company like Marshalls, which is building materials. It makes paving stones, roofing products, that kind of thing. The housing market has been very, very tough. House builders pulled back on volumes last year, and that meant Marshalls' PBT was down roughly 50%. And its dividend, if this had been pre-COVID, the company might have tried to keep its dividend flat, but now it has a payout ratio and it stuck to it and it roughly halved its dividend. And that's that.
Hmm.
That makes my life more difficult in terms of forecasting income. But, and it's a big but, for the investment trusts, it doesn't matter. We've got revenue reserves that have built up over many years. We've got capital reserves that have built up for many years as well. We can smooth the dividends for shareholders so they don't need to worry about Marshall's halving its dividend. Something else will probably offset that elsewhere in portfolio income. And if it doesn't, we've got revenue reserves and capital reserves and it all smooths out. And I think this will be something that we've got to take shareholders with us on and boards with us on in understanding that income might be a bit more volatile now in the UK market. But I think that's actually an advantage for the investment trust as a vehicle, investment trust structures. I think they can be very useful for people in providing predictable income when the overall market income might be less predictable.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you certainly, but it feels like ancient history now, but certainly saw that in 2020, didn't you? So.
Definitely. I mean, it was, with an open-ended fund, you get what you get.
Yeah.
With an investment trust vehicle, most kept on. It was an active debate, but we've seen a good dividend recovery, thankfully, after that year. And I think you're right. I think the structure really showed its use during a year like that.
So you kind of spoke about, I suppose, the profile of the UK markets, and that's, something our listeners are very interested in, very perhaps frustrated by the travails of the UK market and so on. I had a few things I wanted to ask, but, do you see any kind of interesting silver linings or, without asking you too much to predict the future, any kind of reasons for hope that things might actually improve for kind of UK equity investors after... we've discussed depressed valuations. Before recording, we're talking about the kind of M&A taking out interesting companies and so on. And yes, where's the hope?
Where are the catalysts?
Yeah.
So let me give you my view. And as always, as you said, this is a prediction, so take it with a pinch of salt. I think there's two, in my mind, there are two valuation discounts being applied to the UK market at the moment. And the first the debate that people have is this structural? You know, is the UK market broken? And the second is cyclical, as in, is the UK economy in a dire state and it's never going to recover? So if we take the structural question, there are a whole host of policy initiatives being thought about. You know, I often have investors come up and to me and say things like, what do you think about X policy initiative? And I'll say, oh, I haven't heard of that one. You know, there's such a long list of policy initiatives and umpteen different task forces and things, you know, considering UK capital markets, and also umpteen different UK fund managers coming out very publicly and talking about it in a way that I think people would have felt quite uncomfortable doing even 12 months ago. You know, it really does feel like there's a bit of a groundswell of the UK fund management community now coming out and saying, this is a problem, you know, focus on this, please. So it feels to me like the structural discount, which has been around for a while, is finally getting some policy attention. And I think it's because the scale of, you know, like we were speaking about beforehand, the scale of things like de-equitization has reached a point where you can't ignore it anymore. You know, there's been so much of the UK small cap market. I think the stat was something like 10% of all of the operating companies in the FTSE small cap index went last year. 10% in 12 months. I mean, that's shocking. So there does need to be policy focus, but to me it seems like there is, and I'm hoping that something will come out of that. You know, I think it's silly to try and pinpoint which one gets picked or when, but it does seem like there's a focus on the area. So that's the structural side of things. And then there's the cyclical side of things, which is, if we think about, you know, this time 18 months ago, people thought that 2023 was going to be a steep recession year for the UK. And obviously it did turn out to be a technical recession year for the final two quarters.
Yeah.
But I mean, the UK economy is best described as just bumbling around zero. I mean, it's not in steep recession equally. It's definitely not in strong growth. But it's not the kind of recession that people were fearing at the beginning of calendar 23. And I think it's fair to say, if you look at the economic data from the start of this year, it has generally pointed to what I would say is modest green shoots. So things like consumer confidence, business confidence, PMI data points to modest upticks. And if you look at things like regional PMI data, it does point actually to pretty good pockets of strength in places like the Midlands and London. So it looks like, you know, much weaker in some areas like the Northeast, but it does point to a pretty robust economy actually in pockets of the UK. So I would say the cyclical element is showing signs of improvement, and the structural element, I'm hoping there will be some policy initiatives in the area. We're recording this before the 6th of March, but I'm hoping we might get something on the 6th of March.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see what happens on that front. I was going to ask another question I'm interested in is just your mix of kind of UK listed and kind of overseas stocks. You do see this perhaps more than you might expect with UK income funds. Sometimes they have a few kind of interesting US listed stocks and so on. But I was looking at your kind of your latest results, and over a year your UK exposure has ticked up a bit, and perhaps Europe's ticked down a bit and so on. But how currently is the kind of, in terms of appeal, is, I suppose, the kind of UK listed exposure stacking up versus, you know, the great companies in the US and the interesting names in Europe and so on?
So at the moment, and this is for Lord Venture that we're talking about here, we have 88% in UK equities, and that would be definitely towards the high end of where it's been historically. I mean, within recent years, I would guess that the average would be about 80% in UK equities. So to have 88% is definitely towards the high end. And look, we're not saying that there aren't brilliant companies in the US. That's not what we're saying. But what we're saying is there is what feels like a very compelling valuation opportunity in the UK at the moment for all the reasons that we've just been discussing. And for a lot of these UK companies, they're listed here, but they could easily not be. You know, something like GSK, which again is one of our bigger holdings in Lord Ebb, you know, global pharmaceutical firm. Yes, it's listed in London. It's just a global pharma company. You know, there's no particular reason that it's listed in London. A lot of its sales would be in the States for things like its HIV portfolio. Why does GSK deserve to be on 10 times earnings when much of, you know, many of the European pharmaceutical companies, US pharmaceutical companies would be on multiples well above that? that to me doesn't make a great deal of sense. And you could say that for so much of the UK market. So it's not, you know, I'm sure there are, of course there are great companies in the US and Europe, but we think the most compelling valuation opportunity at the moment is here in the UK. So we've been bringing money back. We sold some of our US holdings last year, the likes of Applied Materials, which had been a good performer, the likes of Caterpillar, and brought that money back to the UK.
And I'm also interested to see you mention kind of smaller companies in the latest results. Like how prominent a part of the portfolio is that, and kind of what names have you been turning to?
So roughly, again, this is for Lord Ebb as an example, we've got about 50% in the 100 at the moment. And then we've got roughly 10, I'm rounding a bit, then we've got roughly 10% overseas, and the rest is in small and mid-cap in the UK. So we would definitely be overweight versus our benchmark, which is the all share in small and medium-sized UK companies. We've mentioned a couple of these already, ones like IDS, so Royal Mail is now a FTSE 250 company, you know, having at times been in the 100. We would also be adding to the likes of something like Marshalls, that building materials company that I spoke about, so paving slabs, roofing, that kind of thing. A company like that, it has had a tough time in recent years because house building volumes have been weak. RMI spend, so repair and maintenance improvement spend, has also been weak, leading to that halving of its PBT. But management think that if volumes get back to anywhere close to where they were in 2019, that the PBT, profit before tax, could feasibly double from where it is now. So I think a recovery type of stock like Marshalls, we also own Ibstock, one of the big brick manufacturers in the UK. I think things like that look interesting, particularly if we're looking at interest rate cuts. You know, we can debate the precise month of it, but it's looking likely towards the latter half of this year. If that leads to house building volumes picking up, consumers potentially having more confidence to go out and spend, then that could be positive for those types of Marshalls, Ibstock type names.
I mean, beyond that, are there any kind of particular interesting themes driving decisions in the portfolio? I guess maybe you could see that as a broad optimism for the economy and so on, but is there anything else kind of?
I'm wary of themes, personally. We've got 150 stocks in Lauder. We've got roughly 100 in Lowland, more like 80 in Hot Henderson Opportunities Trust. What we're looking for almost is the opposite of a theme. We're looking for diversification. And I think with Lauder Venture in particular, people or our end clients tell us that they're often holding it as their entire equity exposure. So we think of it as almost a sort of one-stop shop for your equities. And we're very conscious of that when we're making investment decisions, that we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. You know, people want diversification. So there are, as you say, there are the recovery type holdings, whether it's Marshalls, Ibstock, you know, there's what you could describe as global structural leaders, whether it's Rolls, whether it's Flutter. There are next generation technology companies, your fuel cell companies in there, like Ceres and ITM. It's a very, very broad list. And the idea is that they don't move together. And we saw that last year. The recovery shares like Rolls and M&S did well, but it was offset by commodity prices did reset post-Ukraine. Some of the natural resource companies did far less well. So there are always different elements of the portfolio pulling in different directions, and that's how we want it to be. You know, if you were a gardener, you'd say you don't want all your flowers in the garden blooming at the same time. You have to have that genuine diversification across the portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Well, to draw from the IC, our regular portfolio clinic feature, a problem people often have is they have too many stocks. So yeah. How do you actually monitor so many?
The reality is that we have resource across Janus Anderson. So I work at Janus Anderson with James. We are not covering 150 stocks ourselves. We have, to give you a few examples, we have a natural resource team that help with the likes of Anglo American. We have, a guy, a lovely guy that sits a couple of seats down from us that covers financials globally that can help us with the likes of Beazley, the likes of HSBC. We have pharmaceutical analysts set out in Denver that can help us with the Glaxos, the AstraZenecas of the world. So we're not trying to cover 150 stocks ourselves. I think that would be very, very challenging. So we do, we have a global firm kind of sat behind us. Obviously, the ultimate decisions rest with us, but we have a lot of it in-house capability that we can use.
Mm. And just turning back to, you know, something interesting you mentioned before and I alluded to, this is, you know, something that very much divides fund managers, but you mentioned kind of M&A. You know, what's your kind of take on that? Do you see any kind of, I suppose, turn in the way things have been in recent times and so on?
So I guess I thought that the UK valuation discount could correct in a number of ways. And one of those was M&A, that if you didn't see the UK market re-rate itself, that you would start to see takeovers coming in thick and fast. And we did see that to an extent last year. And actually, we've already had one bid turned down this year for a company called Elementis, which is a specialty chemicals company. We own in Lauderdale as well as elsewhere. It turned down a bid from private equity. I think the bid was actually in December, but it came out in January. So we've had one bid like that already. I think, you know, these takeovers, they feel very nice on the day, and that you see your performance pick up and you think, yes, great, okay, you know, ha, I was right about that company. But it actually isn't helpful over the long term, because the best companies, well, it tends often to be the best companies that get picked off. And at the moment, there isn't really anything coming in the other side. There are pretty much no IPOs happening. If you get M&A and you, it's probably stating the obvious, if you get M&A and you don't get IPOs, the market shrinks, which isn't a particularly healthy dynamic. So it is helpful in one way and not in another. I would say there is a bit of differentiation between private equity takeovers and peer takeovers. The private equity takeovers are often happening at valuation levels that are very low.
Mm.
And at share prices that are often lower than where the shares were 12 months ago. But if you get a peer takeover, so for example, in Lowland, we had a takeover of Numis by Deutsche Bank, and we had a takeover of Devro, which made sausage casings, by a European peer. And in both those cases, the premium, there was a good premium to the share price, but also the valuation, you know, most importantly, the valuation to me looked fair in both those cases because they were peers. And if it's a peer taking the company over, there can be synergies, and you as the shareholder get to benefit from some of those synergies. Whereas if you're PE, you know, most of the time that doesn't happen. And you're getting some pretty miserly takeover premiums from private equity, I think, knowing that there are some UK fund management houses that are in outflows that need cash.
Mm.
So you're seeing some pretty opportunistic deals. So I don't want to be too down on all of the acquisitions. I think there have been some acquisitions that actually, you know, when the Devro bid came in, I thought, yes, okay, that seems a fair price for that business. Yeah, okay. You know, we voted for that deal. But I would say those are the exception. Most of the takeovers are happening at fairly low valuations.
Mm. And I suppose you'd probably want a reasonably chunky premium to justify kind of a good holding and, you know, all your sacrificing kind of in the future and so on.
Definitely. I actually think we need to move away from thinking about premiums and looking at valuation. You know, what slightly annoys me is when you get these statements that say, well, this is a 50% premium to the undisturbed share price. And you think, okay, well, it's kind of irrelevant if you're taking it over at 10 times earnings. You know, the share price doesn't matter. It's the valuation that matters. And you do hear that push back to you sometimes. Well, it's 50% premium. Okay, well, it was 50% higher 12 months ago. It's the valuation that matters, not the share price.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I think lots of food for thought there, but I'm afraid we are out of time. So I'd just like to thank you, Laura, for taking the time to come in. And thank you to everyone for listening. Take care.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.